Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to week 6, topic 5 of our When Science and Torah Clash series. I'm impressed that we had the turnout throughout the series. Quite a few people told me they couldn't make it for today's session and last week's session, but never expected January and February to have this solid a group. So thank you very much. I do want to make sure to note that starting not next Wednesday, but in the beginning of March, we have a 4-part series. You should have already received the flyer by email. And that will be with Rabbi Ziering. It's on the Jew victorious and events from Tanakh as well as Jewish history when we've actually won our wars and how the Jew responds to winning. So that will be in March. And then after Pesach in May, God willing, I'll be doing a 4-part series called The Jewish Marriage. We'll be working our way from dating. I think week 1 is dating, week 2 is marriage, week 3 is divorce, and week 4 is... I didn't say that. And then week 4 is same gender attraction. So we can cover our bases. That'll be a 4-week class in May, God willing. There will be a flyer and so on. Don't worry, you'll get email about it. But in terms of week 6 of this series, over the course of our first 5 weeks, we saw 3 fundamental elements of the potential clash between science and Torah. We talked about reasons for rejecting the claims of science. We talked about the idea of divine authority versus human. We talked about the potential weaknesses of the scientific model, arguments that particular laws are immune from new discoveries and from change, the idea of honoring tradition. We then talked about options for reconciling apparent clashes between Torah and science. We talked about the idea that sometimes the sages are just working with the science of their day, and in fact, it may be inadequate. We talked about the idea of revisiting old sources within Torah that seem to predict modern discoveries when we dealt with the age of the universe. We talked about reinterpreting Torah in the light of new information. Like in the discussion of Copernicus and the idea that everything is not going around the earth, but instead we are going around other things, and how that changes the way you look at stories like Joshua stopping the sun. And we talked about last week the expectation that Torah should be a science book, that I should be able to look at Torah and draw scientific information from it, and whether in fact I would trust medicine prescribed by the sages of the Talmud. And that was our third theme. So this week, for our wrap-up week, I want to take a blend of these discussions by looking at a particular case, and that is the case of spontaneous generation. Spontaneous generation is the idea that creatures come into existence out of other material that is not mommy and daddy creatures. In other words, the idea that maggots can be born out of fruit, not because there was an egg laid in the fruit by a fly, but the fruit generates the maggot. This is going to be a gross class. I apologize in advance. Just know that. But the idea that fruit, meat, grain, whatever it is, could actually produce living beings without there being mommy and daddy living beings. That's called spontaneous generation. Another term for it is abiogenesis, as in A-B-I-O. Genesis, as in without Genesis, without life, not coming from a living being, but coming from dead matter instead. So the rabbis appear to believe in it in the Talmud, as we're going to see, and they even establish laws on that basis, as we'll see. And so the questions we need to ask are: number one, are the rabbis wrong when they make the statement that living things can come from dead matter? We don't generally believe in spontaneous generation today. I'm going to talk about the scientific evolution on that a little bit later. And then the second question is, if the science in fact is right, and the rabbis who created these laws based on incorrect science are wrong, then does that change the law? Do we now say, well, we should practice differently because the science was wrong? So that's where we're going with this. We're going to begin by looking at what these laws are that assume spontaneous generation, looking at the science of it and the rejection of the idea of spontaneous generation, and then we're going to ask the question of, number one, so are the rabbis wrong? Can we admit it? And number two, the question of, so does that change the law? Clear? As always, interrupt me in the middle. If you wait till the end, you're not going to get a word in. That's the way it works. I'm going to use 60 minutes. So please make sure to interrupt. Okay. So we begin by looking at a passage from the Talmud in source number one. It's dealing with the laws of Shabbat. Does everyone have a source sheet? Oh, you've got it there, okay. A passage from the Talmud, they're talking about one of the 39 milachot. Milacha is a term that we use to refer to a task, and in particular, the tasks that were involved in creating the Mishkan. What was the Mishkan? The temple that the Jews traveled with in the Midbar, in the wilderness, on their way from Egypt into Canaan, and that we used as our center for centuries until the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem. So that's the Mishkan. There were 39 different categories of creative work involved in building and maintaining the Mishkan. And those are the categories of creative work that are prohibited on Shabbat. So one of those categories is called in Hebrew Netilat Neshama, which means taking a life. Taking a life. Because one of the things they did was they used animal hides in the Mishkan. They used it for the roof of the Mishkan in particular. And in order to get the hide from the animal, you have to slaughter the animal. So that's one of the actions involved in creating the Mishkan. And that's one of the actions then that is prohibited on Shabbat. So with that in mind, we turn to source number one, which... It follows a Mishnah, the core text of the Talmud. A Mishnah had made a statement which implied that one would be liable for killing certain crawling creatures. There are crawling creatures for which one is liable for killing them on Shabbat. There are crawling creatures which one is not liable. And so the Talmud asks, who is the author of... Actually, I shouldn't say that. The best way to say it is actually not quite the way I wrote it on the page, but that one is liable for killing certain crawling creatures. Crawling creatures means not, you know, cows, camels, donkeys, not birds, not fish, but creepy crawlies. Creepy crawlies may mean lice, as we'll see. That's going to be a particular example. There are others that fit into the category. So the Mishnah implies that one is liable for killing certain crawling creatures. And the Talmud asks, who is the author of this Mishnah? It's unattributed. I want to know who the author is. In the Talmud, you always want to know who the author of a Mishnah is, because that determines its authority. If somebody else disagrees... So I need to know the level of authority of the one who said this law and the level of authority of the one who said that law, and that may help me determine who wins in the dispute. So who was it who said that a person is liable for killing certain crawling creatures on Shabbat? Rabbi Yirmiyah said, this is Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer was the author. You may be familiar with Rabbi Eliezer because he was the Rebbe of the teacher of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva tends to be more famous, I think, today because of the attraction of the story of someone who's 40 years old and then he starts learning. And there are a lot of great stories with Rabbi Akiva. Well, Rabbi Akiva's mentor, his teacher, is Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi Eliezer is the author of that Mishnah because we've learned. Rabbi Eliezer says, one who kills a louse on Shabbat is like one who kills a camel on Shabbat, meaning I don't care if it's small or big. It doesn't matter. It's a living thing, and therefore you'd be liable. That's Rabbi Eliezer's position. Rabbi Yosef challenged and said, wait a minute. The sages only disagreed with Rabbi Eliezer regarding a louse, that particular creature, which does not procreate. But they did not disagree with him regarding other crawling creatures, which do procreate. In other words, lice are unique. So in other words, the sages would agree with Rabbi Eliezer about most things. They only disagreed regarding lice. And that's the key point that I want to draw from this passage in source number one. Is that Rabbi Eliezer says that if one who kills a louse on Shabbat is liable, and the sages disagree and say, no, you're not liable if you kill a louse. Why? Because they don't procreate. Now, it was very funny. I prepared this source sheet. I finished the source sheet, and I'm sending it out, And just at that moment, I get an email in from my daughter's school that they have now lice and they're doing a lice check tomorrow, which is today. And I'm thinking, well, someone should tell them they don't procreate. We're good. What do you mean lice don't procreate?
Because they never saw lice mate. They didn't see the eggs, probably. I don't know.
But they lay eggs.
The nits.
They do lay eggs. Of course you can see the lice
know,
eggs.
I mean,
they never saw them?
I don't know.
What happened?
Nits? I don't know.
They all had bad vision. There were no glasses.
No, I don't know. Maybe they didn't associate the nits with the lice.
That could be. Yes?
I had an uncle who was a survivor of the Holocaust, and he said the lice bothered him when he was dirty, when he was clean, when he had a chance to change his shirt, and he wore clean clothing, then the lice bothered him. So it actually contradicts what we normally think about in terms of lice.
Interesting. Interesting.
I've heard that they go to clean.
Don't know. It's certainly not what you normally hear, the stereotype. But in terms of this issue of whether they procreate, there are baby lice. They have a life cycle. What they're trying to say is that lice are generated from material, dead material, and not from other lice. That's the idea that is being proposed here as the view of the sages versus Rabbi Eliezer, who disagrees. And the disagreement is not, I think they procreate, I think they don't. Rabbi Eliezer and the sages agree that lice do not procreate. Their debate is that a critical factor when it comes to the laws of Shabbat? Why should that be the basis for whether I'm liable for killing it on Shabbat? Why does it matter whether it procreates or not? If it's a living thing or it's not a living thing? And that's its own discussion, which I don't want to get involved with right now. I just want to show you the last two lines now in source number one, where Abaye says to Rav Yosef, Abaye is a sage from the 5th century, he turns to his teacher, Rav Yosef, and he says, don't lice procreate? You taught me yourself the following lesson. God sits and feeds everything from the horns of the Re'im, which is a large creature, to the eggs of lice. That means there are eggs. To which Rav Yosef replies, no. That's not what I meant with the words in Hebrew, Beitzei Kinim. This is actually a species of creature called eggs of lice. That's the name of the creature, like bird of paradise, eggs of lice. It's a really small creature, and so they call it eggs of lice. Okay, go figure. The point is that you have here a view that they are produced by material, and they don't procreate. They don't generate new lice. Something else must be going on with teenage lice, because if they're not, I don't know what their big ambition in life is. But that's the idea for these lice. There's a lot of debate in the sages following the Talmud regarding which species of lice they're talking about. There's one that's called a kina in Hebrew. There's another one called a parosh. But that far into the specifics of lice, we're not going to go right now. But it will matter later that there is such a debate. The point is, you're telling me there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. He's saying, I'm allowed to kill lice on Shabbat. If I see a louse, I'm allowed to kill it on Shabbat because they don't procreate. Well, if I find out they do procreate, does the law change? Now I'm not allowed to kill them anymore. Right? Now I'm not allowed to kill them on Shabbat because now they're just like all other creatures. You see the question? So is the science right, and the rabbis were wrong, and does that change what we do, how we do business? That's one law. I'll bring you a second law. This is even grosser. Okay, just know that. It's based on a passage in the Talmud in a volume called Chulin. The Talmud differentiates between, well, let me say it a little bit differently. You know that there are laws of kosher and non-kosher creatures, right? What makes for a kosher animal?
Choose
its cut and split hooves, right? And we also have kosher fish. What makes for kosher fish?
Scales.
Fins and scales, right? And kosher birds. The Torah lists the species of birds that are not kosher, and then we're supposed to know from that which ones are the kosher birds. And the Talmud brings various signs of kosher birds, all well and good. What about creepy crawly creatures? So when it comes to grasshoppers, there actually are kosher signs, which Ashkenazim tend not to know. Yemenites say, well, we know, and therefore they can eat kosher grasshoppers, and I leave that to them. But when it comes to other creepy, crawly creatures, they are not kosher. So when I buy vegetables, if I buy vegetables that are known to be infested with creepy crawlies, I have to clean them. If there's a chance that they have bugs in them, I have to get rid of the bugs. However, the Talmud that I'm referring to now, the passage in the Talmud, is Chulin, page 67a, differentiates between creatures that grow in a non-land medium and stay there, and those that emerge from the medium. Meaning, let's say, and I apologize if anyone's squeamish, you might just want to ignore the next few seconds. But if I buy a fruit, right? What's the old line, right? What's worse than biting into an apple and finding a worm?
Finding half a worm.
Exactly. So in the event that I bite into a fruit and I find a worm there, am I allowed to eat the worm? So I would have assumed no, because worms aren't kosher. However, in the event that it actually became infested after the apple separated from the tree, after the apple separated from the tree, at some point, some maggot, you know, whatever, some fly laid its eggs, and it developed the worm. Then, as long as the worm never left the fruit, it's kosher. It's considered part of the fruit. Pretty gross. I'm sorry. I should have given you like a disclaimer in the email. Take a look at source number two. It's based on a biblical verse that describes the non-kosher creatures as those which crawl upon the ground. This never crawled upon the ground. It was inside the fruit. So Maimonides writes, based on that passage in the Talmud, species of creatures which are created in fruit and food, note the term, created in fruit and food, if they separate and travel on the ground, then even if they subsequently return to the food, one who eats an olive-sized amount is liable. Once it leaves the fruit, now it becomes a different creature, and even if it goes back in, it's non-kosher. And he quotes the verse, the crawling creatures which crawl upon the ground, those are the ones that are not kosher. The exemption is only where the food became wormy after it was disconnected from the ground, meaning if it was still on the tree, it's considered part of the ground. It's when it's separated that changes. So again, this is predicated on the assumption that creatures that are in the fruit were generated from the fruit itself, not from something from the outside. That's what this is based on. There's a lot more to say about that, but that's the basics of it.
A nice question.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to the previous one.
Yeah.
Where first of all, this one, the gross part about it is the stupidity of it. Obviously, if we believe in spontaneous generation, it's not stupid. But
right.
Even if it is, it's okay. A same-sex animal. But the thing that makes me dizzy here is the halachic nature of killing the louse or not killing the louse, whether it's on Shabbat or not Shabbat, whether that sort of animal can be killed. It has nothing to do with the louse. It has to do with the action of killing taking this action. If you can't kill a mouse, you can't kill a louse on Shabbat. It's what you do on Shabbat. It has nothing to do with the poor animal. That one time it's the animal that's halakhic to be killed, another time it's not halakhic to kill the animal.
Is that true?
Well, in my opinion, it should be, because it really depends on the Jew and the action that the Jew takes on Shabbat.
So you're saying killing is killing no matter what it is?
Exactly.
But is that true? Meaning, you define an action only based on the verb and not based on what is acted upon and what is used?
It's not the verb, it's the Jew,
yeah,
and what the Jew is doing.
I think the word context is exactly right. I think context does affect the meaning of an action. Absolutely. I have a mitzvah on Sukkot that I'm supposed to pick up the four species and wave them around, right? Doesn't it matter whether what I pick up is a lulav or an apple?
On Sukkot?
I have a mitzvah of taking the four species, the arba minim, the lulav, the etrog, the hadas, and the arava, and waving them around.
Yeah.
So doesn't it matter whether I pick up one of the four species or I pick up something else? You could say to me, well, you're waving things. What does it matter? If I pick up an apple branch, right, that counts too. The context does matter. And killing is not necessarily killing no matter what. If you consider this to not be a living being, for your definition of life, then absolutely it's not the same. I'll give you a different example. Here's a great question. Cooking, right? You're not supposed to cook on Shabbat. What defines cooking? What if I heat something up in a microwave? Is that cooking?
Yes.
Why? What defines heating up in a microwave as cooking? In the Mishkan, I guarantee you they didn't microwave anything. What defines the act of cooking? Forget the electricity question. You're right, but leave out electricity. My question is the cooking itself. What makes that cooking?
Fire.
What fire? It's a microwave. There's a fire in the microwave. You have a problem. Sorry? What? That didn't cook anything, putting it in. I'm avoiding lights and electricity and everything else. What makes something an act of cooking?
Changing
the state of the food from inedible to edible. But you have to define inedibility, you have to define edibility, you have to define food. What if I cook something that's not food? What if I have a piece of clay that I shape into a bowl, I put it in a kiln? Right? Is that cooking? Yeah.
I'm a former epicurist, but the point is, aren't you just fall in the realm of work during the 6 days? Man's being in charge, whereas Shabbat defines the creator as the owner. So doesn't cooking, no matter what, well, how it's defined, the act of physical preparation is part of the work philosophy.
Right. So that's a very important point. When we talk about what one may or may not do on Shabbat, the Torah does not say not to do work. What the Torah says is not to do melacha. And melacha is a particular word. There are many words in Hebrew for work. Avodah is the normal one, right? Like an eved is a slave. Melacha is a term that is used in the Torah in two contexts in particular. One, creation of the world, and when it says God stopped his melacha for the seventh day, and the other is creation of the Mishkan. And so the Talmud says, those actions that are involved in the creation of the Mishkan, those are the ones that the Torah is saying, stop for Shabbat, and only if it fits into that paradigm. So for example, I could, within the laws of Shabbat, decide I want to move all the furniture around in my room and not be violating any melacha whatsoever. You'd say it's work, and it is, but it's not melacha. It's not within the forbidden thing. That doesn't necessarily mean that you should do it on Shabbat. There's another aspect of Shabbat, which is create a day of rest, and that's its own discussion. It's not restful for you to move furniture around. But from the melacha perspective, and I know people aren't necessarily that familiar with this, but it's fundamental to Jewish law of Shabbat. It's not about don't do work. It's about don't engage in this particular set of tasks. That's actually what's within it. The most common misunderstanding of this comes to doing business on Shabbat. I find when I talk to people, if I ask a group of people what are you not supposed to do on Shabbat, generally speaking, okay, for a particular example, generally speaking, the top two examples I get are light a fire and go to work. They're right about light a fire. That's one of the 39. Engaging in commerce on Shabbat is a rabbinic prohibition. It's not biblical.
But then what is engaging in commerce? Two guys meet at shul and they say, hey, I have a piece of property for sale. How much do you want for it? And they start bargaining.
Yes.
Is that engaging in commerce? I think it's engaging.
It's engaging in commerce once you come to an agreement, although Isaiah says you're not allowed to speak in commerce either, and that's where you get your conversation they shouldn't be having during the rabbi's speech. But I would love to talk about this more, but I'm going to go back now to the topic at hand. But that's the idea, that context matters a great deal in defining whether an act is permitted or prohibited. It isn't only about, well, you said not to kill and he's killing. I'm going to actually go further with this. All right, fine. One comment.
Killing an animal on Shabbat, if that's threatening to your life, I presume it's permissible.
Yeah, threats to your life are a completely different category. Not only that, there are potential permissions when you're dealing with one that isn't a threat to life and death, but that would cause great pain. People who have allergic reactions to bee stings, for example, that aren't fatal, but would cause problems. Like that. This is not intended to be a statement of practice. For a statement of practice, you should ask your rabbi. Don't make assumptions about it because you could guess wrong. But this is based on the idea that the maggot, the louse, is coming from fruit, the meat, whatever it is. The idea is spontaneous generation. Science has come to reject the idea of spontaneous generation. I gave you two links in source number 3 for good references on this that you can look up if you like. But giving you a little bit of a history to this, going back to the 4th century before the Common Era, okay, 2400 years ago, Aristotle says that abiogenesis, this idea that creatures could be created from dead matter, is normal. He says there are 4 different types of procreation, and this is one of them. And that's standard belief. Standard scientific belief is that living beings can come out of dead matter. You know, Albertus Magnus, who was a German scientist in the 13th century, considered to be very knowledgeable in biology of plants and animals, and he took it as a given. Of course, there's such a thing as spontaneous generation. Anton von Leeuwenhoek, right? What's he responsible for? The microscope. Anton von Leeuwenhoek, who discovers invents the microscope in the late 17th century, early 18th century, and he says, you know what I've been looking at? I've been looking at rainwater, and I've been looking at scrapings from my teeth and various liquids, and I found these little things swimming around in it called animalcules. That's the name that's given for them. And those are generated spontaneously within the liquid. Von Leeuwenhoek believes that the microscope has proved spontaneous generation. He's a little confused because after he drinks hot coffee, when he takes scrapings from his teeth, there's nothing in them. It's only if he hasn't been having a hot drink, right? Because the coffee is sterilizing his mouth. It's killing, you know, the bacteria that was there. A good use for coffee. John Needham is an 18th century English scientist. He's also a Roman Catholic theologian who reads about Leeuwenhoek's discoveries, and he says, I am going to support the idea of spontaneous generation. And in 1745, he does an experiment. He heats up chicken soup, and he pours it into a covered flask. And after it cools off, they investigate under a microscope, and lo and behold, there are microorganisms, which he says, you know, the heat would have killed whatever was there before. So clearly, this is generated by the material. This is generated by the chicken soup. He did it with corn soup also, but I don't know, chicken soup is good. However, some doubt already begins in the 17th century. And this is part of the whole Enlightenment era rejection of what came before, and let's experiment and try things out ourselves. So Francisco Redi is a doctor in Italy, and he does a series of experiments trying to show that dead meat does not give rise to maggots. He fills 6 jars with decaying meat. He leaves 3 of the jars open, and he seals the other 3. The unsealed jars attract flies. The flies lay their eggs in the meat, and lo and behold, there's life on them. The other 3 do not. You know, the sealed jars, nothing develops. So doesn't that prove that the life is not coming from the meat, it's coming from something from the outside? The unsealed jars have it, the sealed jars do not. However, his opponents say, no, it's the lack of fresh air. In order for life to generate, you need fresh air. So he says, all right, fine. He does the experiment again, but instead of sealing half the jars, the ones that he had been sealing before, he puts instead this fine netting over it. Fine enough that the maggots can't get in, the flies can't get in, I should say, but air is able to get in. And he says, once again, there are no maggots in the covered jars. They're on top, trying to get in, but they're not inside. The uncovered jars have maggots because that's what happens. Flies get in, they lay their eggs, and that's how the maggots develop. Well, he doesn't convince everybody. Needham goes back and forth with an Italian fellow named Lazzaro Spallanzani. I'm going to make a long story short and cut to the chase, which is Louis Pasteur. Right? Louis Pasteur in the 1860s invents a type of flask called an S-shaped, or swan, I think, flask. And the idea of the swan-shaped, swan-necked flask is that you have the bowl here, and then the tube comes up, and then it arcs downward, and then it goes up again. And he uses this to prove the point. He says, he boils up the contents of the flask. There's no cap on it. And he boils up stuff in regular flasks. And months later, even years later, there's stuff growing in the open flask. There's nothing growing in this swan-shaped flask. Why? Because everything from the outside, all the organisms that would have fallen in, are trapped in the neck of the flask. There is oxygen. It has the same exposure to heat. So no one can say that there were other elements of the experiment that somehow were sabotaged in the closed flask. But life developed in the open one. It didn't develop in the swan-necked one. And he, at that point, puts to rest the idea of spontaneous generation. There is no such thing as life beginning from dead matter. And that pretty much, I mean, look, you will always find people, I'm sure that today there are people who still argue for spontaneous generation. You'll always find somebody. We're human beings. Our variety is endless. However, that basically puts an end to the discussion in the scientific world. Interestingly, the idea of spontaneous generation shows up, the idea that there isn't spontaneous generation, I should say, shows up in a comment by Nachmanides, going back to the 13th century. The Torah portion that was read in Shul this past Shabbat gives the story of the manna. How often did manna fall in the wilderness?
Every day
for 6 days, correct. What happened if you tried to hold over Tuesday's manna to Wednesday?
Spoiled.
Right? Got spoiled, developed maggots. Take a look, please, at source number 4, where I brought you the verse, where some of the people decided to test God, because that's what we do. And some left from the manna until morning, and it developed worms and became rotten. So on this, some of the sages said, the order's backwards. It becomes rotten, and then it develops worms. Why is the order done this way? So Nachmanides, writing in the 13th century, comments on this, and one of his answers to it is to say, things need not decay in order to become wormy, because it's not coming from the decay of the material, it's coming from outside. So the idea of it is not... I'm not so sure this is what Nachmanides actually meant, but that's what's read into his words, is this idea that actually the worms are coming from the outside. Bottom line is, I have two laws. One regarding killing mice on Shabbat, and the other one regarding eating them if they emerge from fruit. Neither of which do I really want to do. But permitting me, in those cases, to do it, predicated on the idea of spontaneous generation. But I don't believe spontaneous generation is real. I think that these mice are procreating, number one. And number two, I don't think that maggots are coming from fruit. So the number one, does that mean the rabbis are wrong? Number two, is does that change the practice of Judaism? So here we're going to see, in terms of the question of whether the rabbis are wrong, we're going to see another iteration of the debate that we saw regarding the cow that wouldn't die. Right? Where the sages had predicted that if the cow has a certain wound, it is mortally wounded. And the farmer comes to the rabbi and says, you know, my animal had this wound for more than 12 months and it's doing just fine. It's not what we call in Jewish law a trefa. The same discussion that we had regarding the medicine that appears in the Talmud. The same discussion that we had regarding rabbinic explanations of biblical verses that sound like the earth is static and everything is going around the earth. Are they simply wrong? So you will not be shocked to know that there are not one approach to this, not two approaches to this, but three approaches to this. The first approach is to say, yeah, they got it wrong. They didn't know everything. They worked with the science of their day, much like we saw regarding the medicine that appears in the Talmud. We saw the view expressed there. The first person to really make this pitch was actually quite precocious. Rabbi Yitzchak Lampronti, born in the year 1679, dies in the year 1756. He's a rabbi in Italy. Wrote a remarkable encyclopedic work called Pachad Yitzchak. It's a tremendous work. It's 12 volumes, I think, in its standard publication. It's literally an encyclopedia of Jewish law, of ideas, on each item giving you, it's a little more bibliography than encyclopedia, because it's often just look at this, 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 and this, if you want more information about whatever the concept is. Very useful work. So he's coming along, just in terms of the chronology that I gave you before, he's coming along as a proponent of the idea that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. And he believes that long before Louis Pasteur, before Needham. He's roughly contemporary with Francisco Redi, that Italian physician who did the first experiments with the 6 jars, the 3 open ones and 3 closed ones. But he's already convinced, Rabbi Lampronti is already convinced, there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. So he writes a letter to his mentor, or one of his mentors, Rabbi Yehuda of Mantua. And in this letter, the beginning of the letter, he writes what you see in source number 5. He says, I, the youthful author, that's an expression in Hebrew, ani atzair, it's meant to say like, yeah, I know what I'm saying is really above my level, but anyway, this is what I think. He says, if I were not afraid I would say that in our day, when the scholars of reproduction have examined and looked, and they know and have written that all living things of every kind come from eggs, and they have proved it with clear proofs, then one who would guard himself should distance himself from them and kill neither parosh nor kina. You should not kill them on Shabbat. You should accept what the scientists are saying. And regarding this, I say that if the sages of Israel, meaning the ones in the Talmud, could listen to the proofs of the nations, they would acknowledge their correctness. They would agree. As they did in the case of the moving sphere and the fixed constellations. And here he refers you to a passage in the Talmud which I referenced when we talked about Copernicus. There is a passage in the Talmud in the volume called Psachim which describes a debate between our sages and the sages of the nations. Doesn't say who they are, doesn't name them. Regarding how the universe works. And in that passage, as he reads it, our sages actually said that the constellations are what's fixed, and we are moving. In other words, the view that we actually accept today. Right? I mean, everything is moving, but you understand the concept that we are moving more than the constellations are, so to speak. That's the view of our sages. And there, the Greek sages, who are the ones who the Jews are debating with, say no, everything goes around the earth. Everything goes around us. And in the Talmud, our sages gave in. So we were the ones who said that everything else is static and we're moving. But we gave in to the Greeks because they had good arguments. So he says, Rabbi Lampronti, in source number 5, he says, you know, if they were willing to give in then, they'd be willing to give in now. If the sages of the Talmud had seen Francisco Redi's experiments, they would agree there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. And so there's no reason for me to insist, no, we're right and they're wrong. It's not so. You follow? That's the argument that Rabbi Lampronti gives. He says our science was simply not up to snuff. There's another work that gets referenced in this debate. I don't know who the author is, but it's called Keset HaSofer, and it's roughly contemporary with him, who comes in on, maybe a little bit later, and comes in on the side of Rabbi Lampronti, and he says, you know, also all over the Talmud, the sages consulted scientists, whatever scientists meant in their day. So, for example, take a look. Actually, don't take a look, because I didn't bring it there. Yeah, number 7. Sorry. I don't know why, but I inserted number... I inserted number 6 in there for reasons that are not clear to me. Nonetheless. I mean, it just reiterates the point that I made in number 5. He says, what happens is he writes letter number 1, he gets a response, which we'll see, and then he writes letter number 2. And so, just to look at what I wrote in number 6, he says, the Israelite sages who recanted and admitted the view of the scholars of the nations regarding the fixed constellations and moving sphere demonstrated that not everything stated in the Talmud is by tradition. Sometimes the sages of Israel spoke from their intellect and human investigation, not by tradition. You know, not everything is written in stone. Some things were just, this is what we think is true. That was his point there. And then you get this Keset HaSofer, who responds by saying that all over the Talmud they look at what the nation's scholars have to say. Here's one example, source number 7. Rabbi Yitzchak said, a kosher bird may be eaten based on a tradition that is kosher. In other words, someone knows, we've always said, this species is kosher. And a trapper is credible to say, my master taught me this bird is kosher, right? The trappers are experts. Brings you the bird, he says, yeah, this is a kosher species, you can believe him. Rabbi Yochanan said, this is only if he's expert in birds and their names, because otherwise you can get confused. Rabbi Zera asked, when it says master, right? Yes, my master taught me this bird is kosher. Does that mean his rabbi? Or does that mean his teacher, who was a trapper himself? So the Talmud says, well, come in here, because look at what Rabbi Yochanan said. Rabbi Yochanan said he has to be an expert in the birds and their names. If he's a trapper, I know what that means. He could be an expert in the birds and their names. If he's a sage, he may know the names of kosher and non-kosher birds, but he isn't going to be able to identify the birds themselves. He sits in the study hall. The trapper is the one who's the expert. And the point that this author of Keset HaSofer wants to show is that the sages go to the trappers, and they ask them about the birds. And similarly then, If you want to know, is there spontaneous generation or not, you go to the scientist and ask them. You follow? That's the argument. It is even broad as an idea. There was a rabbi in the 20th century, middle of the 20th century, named Rabbi Menachem Mendel Kasher. Absolutely brilliant. Got himself into a whole bunch of very interesting debates. The most famous debate that he was involved with, well, there are two very famous debates he was involved with. One is, how does Jewish law deal with the international dateline? Things like, I cross the international dateline on Shabbos, is it no longer Shabbos? If I cross the international dateline on Friday, is it now Shabbos? Things like that. And then the other one is, for those who are familiar with what an Eruv is, does Manhattan need an Eruv? Or can you say, since it's an island with walls, sea walls that descend to the sea, it doesn't need an Eruv. That is the Eruv. And therefore, no Eruv needed for Manhattan. That was a very big and very interesting debate in the middle of the 20th century. He lost. But he says this could actually be the debate of the Talmud itself. He argues that as Abaye understands the debate regarding the issue of killing these creations, that could be a debate about whether they are considered to procreate or not considered to procreate. That's his argument. However, he notes something that's important to recognize here. He says this business of consulting is done when we don't know. The various cases that are brought where we ask the nations of the world are cases where we have a lack of information. I don't know if this bird is kosher or not. Okay, so go ask them. There are other cases that are similar. As opposed to, no, I believe this bird is kosher. I'm not going to go ask the trapper, is it or isn't it? I believe this bird is not kosher. I'm not going to go ask the trapper, is it or isn't it? He said, if we know, then we don't go outside to ask. And he says, the sages knew there was such a thing as spontaneous generation. That's his argument in response. Yes?
Rabbi, wouldn't the sages have asked the trapper only to the extent of the characteristics of the bird, but not to make a decision?
No, because they're not asking about characteristics. They're asking, is this of a species that classically has been viewed as being kosher? It isn't about defining the characteristics of the bird itself. So that's the idea. And if you will say to me, that's the idea in general. This is a debate of, do the sages think that they know everything, or are they willing to make this consultation? But if you're going to say to me, and this is a point that Rabbi Avram Korman makes, if you'll say to me, well, wait a minute, source number two with Maimonides, he was based on a biblical verse about the crawling creatures which crawl upon the ground. That implies that there are creatures that don't crawl upon the ground. They're born in the fruit. Does that mean that the biblical text thought that there was spontaneous generation going on inside the fruit? The answer is not necessarily. He makes the point that often the Talmud will derive from verses lessons in law which have no practical application. Just because they fit the comprehensiveness of the legal system. You define your categories and you set up your cases. Even if there is no practical application, nonetheless, you need to say the law applies in these cases, not in those, even if that class of cases is actually empty. So you need not read the biblical text as endorsing the idea of spontaneous generation. That's a side note, but I thought it was is important to be aware of. The main point is, again, approach number one is to say the sages of the Talmud consulted with others, didn't believe that they knew everything about science, and in fact they would have changed their mind on this. Clear? Second approach is absolutely not. Rabbi Yehuda Brial of Mantua, in source number 8, writes back to Rabbi Lempronti after the first letter. And he says, no. He says, scientists get it wrong all the time. Go back to that passage about the sphere and the heavens and the constellations. We shouldn't have given in. Yeah, our sages thought that the constellations are static and our world is moving. They went and listened to the Greeks. And in the meantime, science has come around to us being right. That's the argument that he makes in number 8. He says, the sages of that time, meaning our sages of that time, recanted and admitted the view of the scholars of the nations. And in the end, after many centuries, all of the nation's astronomers, investigating via experiments and evidence, have returned to the view of our sages in our original tradition. Why should I wait for them to come around to the idea that we were right? Stick to your guns! That's Rabbi Brial. He says, absolutely not. And then there's a third approach, which is the reconciliation approach. You're right, and you're right. That's okay. And that can work. Meaning, for example, there is one view recorded in the book Orchot Shabbat. I brought it in source number 9. I'm going to say it outside of the text, but you can see it there. Which says, we already noted there was a debate about which species of crawling creature they were talking about in the Talmud. So maybe the answer is they're talking about some species that does, you know, generate on its own, but doesn't exist among us. Our lice have eggs. Those lice don't have eggs. Okay. That's one possibility. A second possibility that is suggested is to say, as we've discussed in other contexts, the world has changed. There was spontaneous generation. Now there isn't. There was spontaneous, degeneration. There was spontaneous generation. Now there isn't spontaneous generation. But I think that the third approach within this school is the most important, because it fits into a major theme in Jewish law in general, and one which I think I alluded to in passing in our first week. You ever buy an esrog? An etrog for Sukkot? Do you know how to look for a kosher etrog? What do you have to look for?
It has tentacles.
The pitum at the top should not be broken off, unless it grew without the pitum, in which case it's fine. But the little stem at the top, right, is supposed to be intact. What else do you look for?
No bruises.
No bruises, sorry. The smell? Not a requirement. Sorry. It's nice. Well, you want to avoid insects and worminess. That's very true.
With loops.
So that's exactly where I was going. What we look for in particular are blemishes, because the Torah describes it with beauty, hadar. It's supposed to be beautiful. And if there are blemishes, and particularly if there are blemishes on the most visible part at the top, then it's considered to be disqualified. But what defines a blemish? So you will say, well, it's a blemish, it's a blemish. Killing is killing, and blemishes are blemishes. However, we have a core principle, which is that which you see is real. That which you don't see doesn't matter in Jewish law. And therefore, the person who's going with a loop, while he may be very committed to this mitzvah, is not actually doing Jewish law anymore. At this point, he's just making himself crazy. He's not looking for insects. He's looking for spots that you can see through a loop. The general principle in Jewish law is, if it's microscopic, then it's not significant. Take a look at source number 10. Rabbi Dr. Leo Levy of Machon Lev in Israel wrote a very interesting article called Hamadah Shabbat Torah. It's a book, The Science of Torah. And he says, we find this neglect of the invisible explicitly in the rulings of recent authorities in a variety of fields, such as the letters of a Torah or mezuzah, which must be surrounded by blank parchment. The rule is that in a Torah, each letter has to stand on its own. It can't be touching another letter. Well, if it looks like it's touching, but I take a microscope, I'm going to see it's not touching. Because it's true, on a microscopic level, there will be space between them. That doesn't matter. And thus, one may breathe air, even though it contains crawling creatures, right? Viruses, bacteria, whatever. And one may drink water, even though it contains protozoa. Right? Protozoa are crawling creatures. Doesn't matter, they're kosher. If you have bugs that you can see, that's a different story. But if they're not visible without a microscope, they don't matter. And so, Rabbi Dr. Yeah.
So
what
does a protozoa have to do with things like raspberries?
Only because they believe, and I think they're right often, that the bugs are visible. You just have to look. There's a difference between saying, I looked and I can't see them, and I didn't bother looking. Yeah, that would be the distinction.
They
don't.
They
don't. Are you sure they say that for home use, or they do that commercially? No, I'll tell you why. Why the distinction? As someone who did work as a mashgiach, and when I was the rabbi of a shul, we had a caterer in our kitchen. There were certain things which I just dreaded them bringing in because I knew it was going to be a lot of work to clean. And if I were working commercially for a company, it would charge them a lot of money to sit there for hours checking their stuff. Because you're not talking about what's happening at one meal at home. You're talking about a meal for 400 people. Right? You want to check head after head after head of broccoli. You want to check a million Brussels sprouts or strawberries or raspberries. I could see the logic in saying we're either going to have to charge you a mint or just tell you not to use them. But if a person at home wants to check and knows how to do it properly, no one should ever tell them it's not kosher.
Well,
It's 100% kosher. You just have to look for that which is visible. If it's not visible, forget it. It's not an issue. That's the basics of Jewish law. So, Rabbi Doctor, just to apply Rabbi Levy's statement here, he says, in terms of the this spontaneous generation, he says the sages weren't saying that these lice are born out of the dead matter necessarily, but you can't see their eggs. You don't see the eggs, you see things that seem to be coming out of nowhere. You go by what the eye sees. Now, there is a little bit of a difficulty, of course, because we can see the eggs. We can see eggs. That's how you check people for lice, right? But maybe what they had was actually something that had smaller eggs, such that they wouldn't see. I mean, there are different species of lice. That to me is not crazy, the idea that it's coming from an egg that they couldn't see. That to me is not the end of the world. Yes?
I know you're going to be angry with this question.
Have I gotten angry yet?
No. But I also know the answer to the question, sort of. This idea of being able to see or not seeing rot, can somebody extrapolate from this into social justice? I didn't see the blind man. I didn't have to give him alms.
So what's the answer, since you know the answer?
The person walking with him puts a cane down in front of him. He says, you didn't trip over the cane. Well, I saw the cane. You saw the cane, but you didn't see the blind man.
No, but what's the answer? The answer is, you have to look. It's not what I don't see because I didn't look. It's what I don't see because I can't see it. That's the point that I just made. The raspberry, I have to look at the raspberry and see whether there's anything visible. If there's nothing visible, and I know what I'm doing, like I'm not, you know, looking at it in a casual way and I'm not looking at it in an uneducated way, but if I know what to look for and I look at it and it's fine, it's kosher. But if I say, oh, look, box of raspberries, let me throw it into my mouth and not look and therefore I won't know about the worms, no, that doesn't work. And the same thing is true in terms of social justice. You have a requirement to look.
All right.
My requirement is to look for those in need. Absolutely, 100%. So, in terms of the... no, you didn't get me angry yet. Sorry, I work hard. Come back to me on Friday afternoon when I'm in the shower. So that's question number one. Question number one is, were the sages wrong with their beliefs about spontaneous generation? You have Rabbi Lampranti who says they're very open to being educated about science, and the answer is they would have changed their mind. You have the second approach, which says scientists get stuff wrong all the time. Wait long enough, they're going to come back to our view again. And don't change your stance. And approach number three, which says there's no dispute here. It could be the world has changed. It could be that their lice are not the species that we see. Or it could simply be they weren't saying these things are generated out of nowhere. They're saying you can't see them reproduce. It's not visible to you. But question number two, the practical question. So does the science change the halacha? Let's say I accept Rabbi Lampranti's view. So now things are different. So we should say you're not allowed to kill the lice on Shabbos anymore. Right? And I'm not allowed to eat the fruit with the worm because I was really, you know, itching to do that. Do you in fact change what you do? So the answer is, maybe. This is never simple. The answer is no. There are two schools of thought. One school of thought says, yes, change what you do, because in this case, it's more strict anyway. It's a chumrah. In other words, if I were to continue doing what the old science said, I would be allowed to kill the lice, I'd be allowed to eat the fruit. So what's the big deal if I just say, you know what, I'll let the lice live. Let them live till Shabbos is over. I'll let the lice be on Shabbos, and I won't eat the wormy fruit. I have to get my protein somewhere else. What's the big deal about letting it be? And this way, I know I've satisfied everybody. Let me just take that view. That's one approach. The other approach says, no, the law is the law. It does not change. Kill the lice, eat the wormy fruit, and live it up. Those are the two schools. Let's go back to the first school. The first school is headed, again, by this Rabbi Lampranti. Rabbi Lampranti's view is to say, and others as well, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv is quoted as saying this too, he says, be strict, don't kill the lice on Shabbos. Rabbi Kasher, though, notes a concern, which I brought you in 11, but I want to say it outside of the text because it requires some explanation. He says, no, wait a minute. There's a concern brought in the Talmud, which is a very big concern, and I think everyone here has probably heard it at one point or another. The case in the Talmud that's often brought as the source for this involves a get. What is a get?
Divorce.
Bill of divorce. A bill of divorce. Has to be written in certain ways. So in the Talmud they mention that there was a fellow who wanted to institute a stringency in terms of the way that they were written and delivered. And he was told by the authorities, you may not institute this stringency. Yes, it's true that his stringency would have helped ensure that everything was done properly. However, it would cause people to doubt the validity of all the gittin that had been done before. Because they would say, well, wait, it wasn't up to the standard that we do today. And on that basis, they said, you're not allowed, even though you intend something positive, you intend to refine our standards, you can't do something that's going to cause people to disqualify what was done before. It's not like what you're talking about is letter of the law. It's just some stringency that you want to bring in. And Rabbi Kasher argued, if you're going to say no killing the lice on Shabbos, so all the people whose grandfather and grandmother did this, you're going to say grandma and grandpa didn't know what they were doing? Bubby and Zadie were breaking Shabbos or were ignorant? How dare you? He says you can't do it. He does relent a little bit and say, well, maybe since people understand nature has changed, they'll realize that their lives were different and they won't view it this way. But in general, Rabbi Kasher, number 11, is really not happy about the possibility of creating a scandal about earlier generations. And so therefore, he's not so happy with the idea of being strict and says, you have to be very careful. Even though you think that what you're doing is nice and what you're doing is to a higher standard, you can't do things that are going to cause people to reject earlier generations. So that's one position. Yes? Sorry.
No.
Early.
I don't know, I'm really prolonged talking. I believe the ethical, the humane emphasis of Judaism, which I inherited although I was never brought up, we didn't my grandson from modern Orthodox, he said there's no logic, you can't logic. I said, on the contrary, there is a logic. From what I see, I've been studying the Bible in English for about 5 years now. There's a tremendous humane element.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous humane. And that's why it hurts me to hear. I'm an Altayin and I'm 90 years old, so I hear a lot of people doing it. They're good people. They say, they're uneducated. They don't know. But you know, if you stop to think about it, what's important is the humane part of it. Of course, the academic and the learning, the intellectual satisfaction, that's what draws me to this.
So I would say a couple of things. I think that what you call the humane aspect of it is certainly vital. But I think that if it all becomes how I relate to other people, and it all becomes what do I think, then it runs the risk of no longer being a religion with a God in it. It becomes what I think. It becomes what, the popular term is Shilaism. But that's the thing. There is a relationship with God. And there is something outside of myself. I gave a brief class this morning at the high school at Or Chaim. And I pointed out a lesson which actually Steven Spielberg mentioned in an interview. It was a beautiful interview. They asked him how it is that he develops characters that ring so true and that resonate with people. And he said it goes back to the most important prayer in Judaism, the Shema. That's what he said. Whether it's the most important prayer or not, I leave to Spielberg. But he said it's the Shema. Listen, right? That's what it is. You have to learn how to listen to others. And he talked about listening to yourself and all of the listening things. I'm not going into the whole class now. But the point is that that it isn't only about me. It's about what I have to learn, too. So I wouldn't get too focused on that aspect of it. Linda, you were going to say.
No, I was just going to just tweak something. There was this case in Israel a number of years ago where there was a rabbi who all of a sudden felt that her faith fell out of favor with the other rabbis, and so they would say that his conversion was done even 20 years ago or something like that,
Yes.
You know, were not valid. And, I mean, this is the extreme.
So I'll tell you what, if you want, I'll come back to that at the end. I want to wrap up this point first, and then we can do that.
Sure.
But we're running out on time here. I'll come back to Sheilaism also, if you like. But the other view, the one view is science does change the halakha, at least to be strict anyway, to make sure that you're covering your bases. The other view is to say no. Jewish law stands apart from scientific theory and discovery, and it will not change. And that's the view of this Rabbi Yehuda Brial, who Rabbi Lampranti consults. He says, you know, there are other areas in which they've rejected our point of view. He talks about the concept of Ayin Hara. We've had classes on Ayin Hara. I'm not going into the topic right now, but there's an idea that if I look at somebody's property and I am jealous of it, I will pray to God to punish this person and to harm his property. And on that basis, there's a law that says that if somebody has a field and the grain is growing, I'm not allowed to go looking into his field, lest I, through this jealousy, trigger something. That's a law. So Rabbi Brial says, you know, the scientists think that Ayin Hara is a joke. But it doesn't change our law. We still say it. We still say not to look into the guy's field. That's his argument, is that laws don't change. To which Rabbi Lampranti says, that's because there's debate among the scientists about Ayin Hara. He says there are those, and he mentions Ovid and Pliny, which, you know, by his day, they're long gone. But in the Jewish world, they're part of the chain of tradition. And they believe in Ayin Hara. So scientists can believe in it also. He says on spontaneous generation, he says, it says there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. But this is the debate. Is to say, maybe it shouldn't change. Maybe the laws don't change. Why not? It goes back to a source I brought you in week one. Source number 14. Rabbi Eliyahu Carmel, quoting Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, in source number 14. And I'll say it outside of the text, but you can see it there. He says, because when you have a law recorded in the Talmud, they know, the sages know what the law is. All the explanations that they give, spontaneous generation, whatever it is, are just ways to understand why the law is as it is. But fundamentally, take away this reason, there'll be another reason. The law is as it is, irrespective of the logic that's presented in the Talmud, and that's his view. And on that basis, he says the law will not change. So to summarize what we've said today, and then I'll go back to Sheilaism, and I'll go back to the case of Rabbi Druckman, which is the one you're referring to. We had two practical, if somewhat gross, you know, laws, right? One, killing lice on Shabbos, and the other one is eating wormy fruit on any day of the week. The laws seem to assume there's spontaneous generation. By 1864, the scientific world knows no such thing as spontaneous generation. So as we saw regarding the cow that wouldn't die, and as we saw regarding Talmudic medicine, and as we saw regarding the heliocentric solar system, everything going around the sun, there's debate about whether the rabbis could in fact be wrong in this. Do we accept that they're wrong in the science? Do we say that the Torah is open to scientific findings? Do we say no, science changes too much, and don't assume that their methods are correct? Or do we say, you know what, you can reconcile the sources. Different species of lice, things change over time, they were working only with the visible. Maybe you can retain faith in the sages without rejecting the science. And when it comes to the practical law, some say yes, accept the science at least to be strict. Accept what the science is telling you. And others say no, the law is independent of the scientific findings. So I thank you very much for participating in the series. This has been a lot of fun for me. It forced me to put some things down on paper in an order that I had not done before. But to address the two questions that were asked, and for anyone who asked to leave,